Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Iva Glišić, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Mark Edele about his book, Debates on Stalinism. Now, Mark is the Hansen Chair in History at the University of Melbourne, specializing in the history of the Soviet Union and its successor states, in particular Russia. His recent publications include Stalinism at War, the Soviet Union in the World War II, the Politics of Veteran Benefits in the 20th Century, and this is a comparative history written with Martin Crotty and Neil Diamond, and the Soviet Union, A Short History. Mark has written extensively on Stalinist society, the Second World War, and Soviet veterans. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Eva.
Mark, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a historian of the Soviet Union, as you said. I've been trained in Germany originally, my undergraduate degree, and then at the University of Chicago for my PhD. And I came to Australia after, an extensive job search for jobs, which there were none. In 2004, I managed to get an ongoing position at the University of Western Australia, where I stayed until 2017, when I moved to my current position at the University of Melbourne.
That's fantastic, Mark. And as I said, you've written really extensively on this period of Stalinism, you focus on in your work on debates on Stalinism, kind of on the historiography of this period. And you open with this observation that there are essentially three major areas of debate in the historiography of the Soviet Union. So there's the revolution of 1917 and the origins of the Soviet Union, the years of Stalin's brutal regime from the late 1920s to his death in 1953, and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Now, noting that your work has largely focused on the Stalin era, I was wondering if you could tell us how you became interested in the historiography of Stalinism, and in particular, the way in which historians in the Anglophone world have engaged with this topic since the mid-1980s, which is where your book begins.
Yeah, so I guess that story probably begins at the University of Chicago in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And so at Chicago, which at the time was probably the biggest program for Soviet history outside of the former Soviet space. So there was quite a few of us trying to, working on related topics and trying to figure out how to make sense of the kind of archival data we were digging up. And like many others, I was exposed there to the kind of what I see as sort of the mythological history of my field, which is that there is, that there used to be the dark days of the totalitarian model, which was driven by Cold War ideology and completely misrepresented Soviet society. Then came the revisionists, who, you know, enlightened us about the existence of society under Stalin. And then came the post-revisionists, who reminded everybody or came up with this notion that ideology was really important. So that was kind of the story as it was sort of told, I guess, to graduate students at the time. But then some of us read stuff from the 50s and the 60s, and some of us quite liked some of the things we read from the 50s and 60s. And we thought this was all very strange. So we formed a little study circle, a kružok, and read relatively systematically literature from the 50s and 60s, particularly scholars connected to the Harvard Interview Project, but also others. And that sort of started conversations about how this story was somehow not right, the story we were told by our teachers. And so that led me to write an essay, a first essay on this, which came out in 2007 with the journal Kritika. And then I was asked, after I took up my position at UWA in Perth, Western Australia, by Oxford University Press, if I wouldn't want to write something for a new series they had, which became my 2011 book, Stalinist Society. And the series was meant to have a final chapter, so that the book itself was meant to be a synthetic account of Stalinism, in my case, from a decidedly kind of social history perspective. But then there was supposed to be a final chapter on historiography. And I was very strongly encouraged to not make this too dry, and make this analytical, not just descriptive, not saying, you know, then this happened, then that person published this and so on, and to contextualize the debates and why they were so, and you know, think about the politics of them and so on. So I then wrote something which I quite enjoyed writing, although as a colleague at the time who read it said to me, nobody's going to talk to you ever again. And it did become quite controversial, and it annoyed a lot of people. And it probably didn't help the reception of the book, I think, because there was a lot of focus on that controversial chapter. But that then led to the invitation to create a proposal for what became Debates on Stalinism, which is in a way an expansion of that one chapter. In many ways. So that's kind of the story behind that. So I was basically approached to write a more detailed investigation of kind of the politics really of my field.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly interesting that you know that this book emerged out of a controversy. And it seems that the entire debate on Stalinism is really history of these historical controversies that you raise. The first part of your book really focuses on life and work of three historians, Sheila Fitzpatrick, Moshe Levin, and Richard Pipes. Mm-hmm. They are kind of the main part of this opening section. So I was wondering if you can tell us about how you decided to focus on these three scholars, and also tell us a little bit about the paths into the field of Soviet history that they had and how they shaped the study of Stalinism.
Yeah, so one of the things, and that might be partially, you know, the perspective of somebody who is, you know, was born and raised in Germany, got interested in Russia and then the Soviet Union, and then was trained in the United States and ended up in Australia. I was interested in displacement, how displacements of people, but also their experiences, right, as scholars and as human beings, shape particular U.S. scholarship, which is very often, which has a lot of that, right? There's a lot of people coming to the U.S. Who come from elsewhere and bring with them all kinds of personal and ideological and historical baggage. So I was kind of interested in the role of this kind of displacement and this kind of transnational history of my field in US scholarship in particular. So I picked scholars who I both, you know, thought were very influential for various reasons, but also who were examples of this kind of displacement. So Moshe Levin and Richard Pipes are both Polish Jews. They're not exactly the same age, but roughly of the same generation. They're from the opposite end of the political spectrum, all right? Levin was a kind of Marxist Zionist, and Pipes was quite from the conservative end of the spectrum. They both leave because of World War II and the Nazis. Pipes leaves in 1939 after the German invasion, in a kind of very adventurous story through Germany, actually, under assumed identity and so on. Levin leaves in 41 after the Germans attack the Soviets, and he leaves from the Baltics, jumping on a Red Army truck and going into the Soviet Union. So now, eventually, after some adventures, you know, Levin eventually leaves the Soviet Union after the war, goes back to Poland, but not very long, then is in Paris, then goes to Israel, and goes back to Paris, gets a PhD, is in the UK for a while, and then ends up also in the United States. But he becomes the kind of grandfather in some ways of, or maybe the father, I don't know, of what becomes the revisionist school, right? So he's quite on the left. He spends a lot of his work basically trying to figure out how you get from Leninism, which he basically thought was a good thing, to Stalinism, which he thought was terrible and an aberration. And he was very influential on the left of academia in the US for that reason. A very good essayist. His essays are some of his most influential writings were essays. Less so a kind of book writer, although he wrote some books as well. Pipes was quite different. Pipes is very conservative. He becomes, one of the proponents of the totalitarian model. He serves in the Reagan administration. He is people often claim that he invented the idea or the phrase the Soviet Union as the empire of evil. When he was asked about this in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, he said, "No, unfortunately, no. I would have liked to, but I wasn't." He barely wrote any essays. There are some, but mostly what he writes are books, but not kind of monographs, which are trying to figure out some very focused problem with a very specific source base, but they're all kind of big histories of, you know, the formation of the Soviet Union, Bolshevism, Russia under the old regime, and so on. So he wrote kind of big books. And he, while Levin was extremely successful within academia and influential within academia, Pipes always felt a bit estranged from academia, although, you know, I had the chair at Harvard, so so bad, but he was very successful in as a public intellectual and then eventually as a political advisor. So in many ways they were sort of I was really originally I wanted to write one chapter which is about both of them, one leaving West, the other leaving East, one becoming a revisionist, the other totalitarian. But it didn't. It was too much for one chapter. So that's those two, and they're just extremely influential characters, and I think examples for bringing politics from Eastern Europe with them to the United States. and to their scholarship. Fitzpatrick, who trained me at the University of Chicago, is quite different. She is from Melbourne in Australia, from kind of the bohemian Melbourne left. Her father was a very influential public intellectual, human rights advocate, and or civil rights advocate, I guess, and journalist, and an important historian of Australia, but outside of the academic establishment. So he always sort of lived on the sidelines. And she brought her and she was an important thing about, I think, Fitzpatrick's approach to history is she was trained in the department at the University of Melbourne, where I occupy a chair now as well, which was very strongly focused on working with primary sources. So her whole habitus as a historian was formed by the sense that what historians do is they go always back to the primary sources, always back to primary sources. And that's something she brought with her as she did her rebellion against her kind of fellow traveler father. But then she also had a secondary socialization in Moscow with not dissident, but sidelined communist intellectuals in Moscow, and this kind of complex history she brought with her to the United States, where she really was one of the important drivers of a professionalization of the history of the Soviet Union, very much against that generation of Levine and Pipes, who were much more. Who were much less interested in methodology than would be Fitzpatrick, but also her peers around her. And she would become kind of the revisionist, although she would write against both the revisionists, like the Marxist revisionists in particular, as well as the totalitarians. And she was a very strong school builder and trainer of a new generation of professional historians of the Soviet Union, of which I am one of them. So I was interested in those kind of stories of how displaced experiences then lead also to terrible misunderstandings of each other, I think, when they kind of clash in. And those three kind of clashed in many ways, among many others, in the U.S. context.
Yes, and they're indeed a source of many controversies that, as I said, frame your book. I was very surprised to read the difference between the training that Sheila Fitzpatrick had in Melbourne and then when she continued her studies in Oxford, which definitely did not have the same focus on primary sources.
Or on training anybody.
Or on training, that's right. It was quite a surprising kind of insight into that training. I was wondering, before we move on to my next question, if you could tell us a little bit about the sources that you used to write about these three historians.
Well, I read their work in the first instance, right? But then I also read their archives. So Fitzpatrick has her papers at the University of Chicago. Richard Pipes has his papers at Harvard, and Levine has his papers at University of Pennsylvania. So I read their and this is mostly pre-computer, right? So their correspondence, they often kept copies, or they kept at least one side of the correspondence you would get. So there was quite a bit with Levine. I mean, he had some very strong correspondence with some people, but he also clearly was somebody who often picked up the phone. So he would spend a lot of time talking to people on the phone, which is, of course, slightly annoying for the historian, because we don't have an archive there. But then sometimes he would get letters from people referring to a phone conversation they had. So that was interesting. And maybe, I mean, one footnote on the Pipes's papers, which require basically permission from his son, Daniel. And although he, and not only did he get me permission to work with them, but the archive then also required me to basically get permission for every single quotation I used from Pipes. And so I sent him the chapter, and he basically said, he just signed off on it saying, of course you can use it. And so despite knowing that I was not, you know, a hagiographer of his father, he was very professional about this, which I thought was, I was very grateful for that.
Yeah, it's always tricky working with personal papers and dealing with families in that process as well. Now, Stalin is obviously the heart of Stalinism. And in your book, you also discuss quite a bit biographical writing on Stalin. Can you tell us how historians approached this genre in the past?
Yes. So, I mean, a lot of that was actually one of the kind of real revelations for myself when I wrote it, because I thought, well, surely I need to write a chapter on Stalin biographies. And I had, of course, read, you know, many of them, but never very systematically. But reading them systematically kind of showed to me how important that genre was to for developing the field and developing a lot of the background knowledge which other historians then used. And so the general story can be maybe told in sort of in chunks of intellectual paradigms. The first were the Marxists. So these were non-Stalinist and very often anti-Stalinist Marxists who wrote still during the time Stalin was alive. So the first of them is Boris Souvarine, who published a very anti-Stalinist account in 1935. Leon Trotsky, of course, who was killed over his a very angry book on Stalin in 1940. Reportedly, his blood splattered over the manuscript. So that's quite dramatic. And then, of course, also Isaac Deutscher, a book from 1949, second edition, 67. And so these were Marxists who tried to figure out how to explain the phenomenon Stalin in Marxist ways. So the general outline or the general approach for that is to try to find a way to account for Stalin as the expression of underlying social forces, right? So the, you know, there's the base, the social forces, and somehow Stalin, if Stalin is part of the superstructure, has to be determined by the base, right? And very often the answer to that is a new class structure emerging in the Soviet Union after the revolution, and Stalin as the expression of this kind of new ruling class. In the process, they did a lot of really good work both on Stalin's career, but also on the wider social history of the Soviet Union. So these are actually very influential accounts, and a lot of later historians learned a lot from them and then often forgot where they learned it from. So that's the first bunch is sort of Marxists. And then you have at the same time more psychological approaches. On the one hand, coming again more from the left, a psychoanalytical approach, basically seeing Stalin as sort of the neurotic in the Kremlin, bringing psychoanalysis to trying to understand this. So this is Tucker in a two-volume book on two volumes on Stalin, 73 and 1990. And the other one is Adam Ulam, who was not influenced by or not overtly influenced by psychoanalysis, but was very interested in ideology. So he saw Stalin as a typical Bolshevik and driven by ideology. So he was very much in the kind of totalitarian framework. But again, both Tucker and Ulam wrote really, really useful books in many ways. However you want to, you know, whether or not you agree with their theoretical background. And they build, of course, on the earlier Marxist approaches, even where they argued with them. And then you get a whole bunch of accounts which are driven by new evidence coming out of the archives. So the first of that one comes out of then still the Soviet Union, Dmitry Volkogonov, which was a Leninist critique of Stalin, but he was already able, because of his position within the Soviet power structure, to see archival documents on Stalin. So he's the first one working with archival materials on Stalin. Then there is when the archives open after breakdown of the Soviet Union, biography is not very fashionable among historians. I think it's something which amateurs do. Real historians do, you know, social history or do cultural history or something like that, but not biography. So we then get a few freelancers who are working with these archives. Edward Radzinski, 1997, Simon Montefiore in 2003 and 2007, who work with new archival data, but also they're writing for not for academics, but for a broad audience. And of course, because they're freelancers, they really need to sell books. So what do you do when you want to sell books? Well, sex and violence, right? So there's a lot on the sex life of Stalin and the Bolsheviks in these books. And then professional historians get interested again in this. And so you get a new, because of the new, all this new evidence that's out there with the open archive. So you get kind of a new group of professional historians, academic historians who write political biography, but with the new archival data from post-91. They're all anti-revisionist or post-revisionist in their kind of approach. This includes Robert Service, a very good biography from 2005, Jörg Baborowski, German scholar from 2012, now also available in English translation. And then the, as of now, two-volume Magnus Opus by Stephen Kotkin of 2014 and 17. And we're waiting for volume
the third, yeah, the third.
But apparently that might take a little longer because it has to deal with World War II and the post-war Stalinist years, which is quite a bit to chew on.
And there's Sunni's biography as well, which is also quite hefty. This is, I wanted to really seek your opinion on the ongoing popularity really of this genre. I mean, you conclude your book with Oleg Klevnuk's exceptional study, Stalin, A New Biography of a Dictator. This was published in 2015, and it's terrific history, but also just a page turner. And since then, we've seen, as you just noted, a number of these kind of hefty biographies on Joseph Stalin being published by professional historians. And so I'm just interested if you might have some thoughts on why this genre continues to be such a popular field among historians.
Well, it's one of the things I think you can do if you want to actually sell books is write a biography, because there is a public interest in, you know, the life of great or not so great men, and increasingly, you know, great women too. But if you want to actually talk to a broader public, that's one way to do it. That was Isaac Deutscher's story. He wanted to really write a social history of Stalinism. That's what he wanted to write. But he also had to make a living, right? He was an exile living in the UK. So he approached a publisher and pitched that book, and they said, nah, nobody's going to read that. But what about a biography of Stalin? People want to read that. And so he basically used the biography of Stalin to write that social history of Stalinism he wanted to write. So I think that's one of the reasons why this is attractive. And as academic historians have started to think more about also talking to a broader public and are kind of encouraged by the institutions to do so, I think that's one reason for that to happen. It's, of course, also the guy is interesting, right? I mean, Stalin, this is not boring. So it's an, you know, there's an interesting story to be told. And as of the latest kind of big wave of Stalin biographies, that was very much driven by this whole new source base, right? You see that with the others too. You have this early Marxist wave. They basically scooped up all of the sources that were available at the time to make sense of Stalin. And then there is, for a very long time, not very much happens until you get new material released under Khrushchev and the thaw. And there's now suddenly more material, new material to work with. So you get this new wave of Stalin biographies, Taka Ulam and others. Then again, there's kind of a lull because there's no new material. There's not very much you can do. And then you get this massive outpouring of material from the archives. And I think we're probably at the end of that wave, right? I think the publications we've seen probably have worked their way through this material. And, you know, we're recording this in the, where are we now, second week of the war in Ukraine. I'm not very optimistic that a lot of new material will come out of Russia anytime soon, or indeed quite possibly Ukraine. So I think there's that as well. There is, you know, the availability of material and working your way through that. And once that has happened, you know, there's no longer a need to write on this, and people will shift to other topics.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, that importance of sources and access to sources is really also part of your story in debates on Stalinism. And I was wondering if we could go back to these question of totalitarianism and revisionism. And you focus on these two major intellectual frameworks that have shaped the study of Stalinism during the Cold War era and track their evolution throughout the book. I was wondering if you can provide a quick overview, you know, for someone who doesn't quite know what totalitarianism and revisionism might be, but also how have these approaches changed following the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Yeah. Well, in many ways, the book is in many ways a polemic with this narrative. I was presented as a graduate student that there's kind of a nearly Hegelian story of progress from darkness to light, from the darkness of totalitarianism through revisionism to post-revisionism, and the history writing getting better all the time as a result, which is actually, I don't believe there's too much evidence for that. Not that there's not an evolution of our understanding, but that there's, you know, that it gets better all the time is not entirely evident to me. But in the 50s and 60s, in the West, and in particular in the US, the notion that the Soviet Union under Stalin, and then there's a discussion about whether or not that was also true before or after, but let's just talk about Stalin, was totalitarian. That meant it was a one-person dictatorship with extremely strong economic, police, and ideological controls, which tried to completely reconstruct society on the basis of this ideology. So there was quite a bit of focus on top-down and on the dictatorship driving things, right? This also had very strong political implications because totalitarianism also referred to Nazi Germany. So it basically said the proper comparison of the Soviet Union is with Nazi Germany. you know what happened when you tried to negotiate with Nazi Germany, appeasement, you get world war and so on. The only way to deal with totalitarianisms is by confrontation. So it had that kind of Cold War implication. And that was a lot of what younger scholars, but also scholars of a generation which otherwise embraced totalitarianism. So Moshe Levine, for example, who would be of the kind of totalitarian generation, but was not one, but actually actively wrote against that, partially because of the political implications. And then the other thing which happened with the revisionists was that this was there came a generation of scholars who were trained during a time when political history became kind of old-fashioned and social history was the kind of cool thing to do. So they all started to do social history, which explored in many ways questions which that older generation was also interested in, but that was not the focus of the public debate about totalitarianism, right? So there's that as well. So there's a generational shift, there's a political shift. Often revisionists and social historians were politically more on the left. Were plenty of Marxists among them, although that's not true for all of them, right? So that's the kind of second big paradigm. And my sense is that story from darkness to light was in many ways written by a generation which tried to define itself in contradistinction to what came before. And in the process, appropriating a lot of the insights and knowledge of the earlier literature, but forgetting where they got it from. Calling things like Merle Fainsort's Smolensk book kind of an exception to the rule of totalitarian scholarship. So then the so-called post-revisionist moment is basically a shift. Again, there's a generational shift, the younger generation of scholars, but also a shift to cultural history in the paradigm of new cultural history, which became fashionable since the 80s, 1980s, as a reaction to social history of the 60s and 70s. So that's then very often seen as the third step. Again, they're elaborating very often aspects of, so for example, regime support, which is a big topic for post-revisionists, was something which some revisionists were also very interested in and were getting an enormous amount of political flack for because people thought they were apologizing for Stalin or were claiming that Stalinism was somehow legitimate because it had popular support. So, I'm kind of trying to tell a little bit the underlying story, which I think is also you learn from earlier literature and then you forget where you get it from. Part of, you know, making a career in academia is about establishing your novelty. And of course, novelty then always has to, you have to kind of misrecognize the extent to which you are very much formed by the people who came before you.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That whole genre of my research fills the gap. And the gap probably is not always there.
I think it's more than just a gap. If you really want to make a career, you have to say you're paradigm shifting.
Shifting, right? Yes.
you're totally doing everything new.
That's right.
And have completely new insights.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, and I'm very skeptical of that.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Slightly sarcastic tone, I guess.
Yeah. Your work also focuses on this relationship between history and memory in post-socialist countries, and indeed how this history of Stalinism is remembered today. This is a major area of study. Can you tell us a bit how you approach this topic in your book?
Well, I have two final chapters which deal really with the memory stuff more than the other. I mean, in many ways, all of history is memory, right? Mm-hmm. So, the borders are very, very unclear there. But I deal with kind of two debates which are kind of contemporary and which are also moving the book a bit more into Eastern Europe than the rest of the book is. The rest of the book is much more centered on English language historiography with its influence of, you know, other historiographies, but it's really focused on English language historiography rather than, let's say, Russian language or Ukrainian language historiography or German or Italian or French, right? But there's two final chapters. One is on the history of the Second World War and how to properly write it and remember it in Russia, which is very much focused on the writings of Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin himself and his interventions in this very highly politicized field, which of course now is entangled in the largest largest ground war since World War II. The other chapter is a history on the Great Famine in Ukraine, also known as the Holodomor now from a Ukrainian perspective. And that one is in particularly interested in the transnational aspect of the evolution of that historiography, first in the Ukrainian diaspora and very much at the margins of academia and very often outside of academia, then eventually within English language academia and then coming back to Ukraine after independence. And so in both of them, I'm very interested in the kind of interaction, I guess, of professional history with memory and how, you know, the two, with public memory, I mean, and how the two are kind of very often in a conflictual and uneasy relationship with each other.
I was wondering if you might want to comment on some of that history of the Second World War within the Russian context and the evolution of how it's has been treated since the collapse of the Soviet Union, how it shifted and what was the focus of that memory over the past 30 years?
Yeah, well, one can maybe go even further back into the Soviet period, right? So the Second World War in particular, what the Soviets and now still the Russians and many in Belarus call the Great Patriotic War, that is the war against Nazi Germany from 41 to 45, that was the center of a Soviet war cult, which in many ways was an embrace by the state of a way to deal with and instrumentalize the enormous trauma which a lot of, well, everybody in the Soviet Union had experienced because of this war. So it became kind of a way to acknowledge this trauma, but also to use it for political mobilization and kind of regime integration. And basically you have an evolution from under Stalin. The story was the Soviet Union under the leadership of the Communist Party under the leadership of the wise comrade Stalin crushed the fascist in an all people's heroic war. Everybody was in, there were no traitors and so on. Under Khrushchev then, under kind of de-Stalinization, Stalin is kind of, it's not removed, but he becomes a scapegoat for everything that went wrong. 1941, terrible, you know, military catastrophe, all Stalin's fault. The repressions during the war, all Stalin's fault, and so on. So Stalin becomes, the story becomes nearly, it's the Communist Party leading the Soviet people in the united struggle against the fascists, despite Comrade Stalin and all of his mistakes, right? Then under Brezhnev, they reinsert Stalin carefully, saying, well, yeah, he made some mistakes, but he was also the competent manager of the war effort. And that's kind of what you get as we go into the 1980s. And then Gorbachev, under the policy of glasnost, opens the floodgates for all kinds of criticism of the war record. So people start writing about the horrors of 1941, the repression during the war, blocking battalions who shoot at their own people, the part of the war which was always not remembered or remembered only in passing, namely the Hitler-Stalin Pact and the occupation of Poland and the annexation of the Baltics, the massive deportations and all of that stuff. It comes all out and it's nearly as if there's a counter myth to the war established, where the war is just won because there's commissars with guns, you know, forcing people into battle and so on. But that was always a minority position because there was too much involved in family histories in this war and in a positive memory of this war. So that a backlash was probably always likely. And under President Putin, that backlash was embraced by the state, partially because I think Putin himself is deeply personally committed to the old war myth, but also because they realized that was one of the things a lot of people could agree on. So the war became a rallying point around what was good about Russia's past. So it's now no longer the Soviet past, it's the Russian past. And it went a little bit from saying, yes, there were all these terrible things, but we shouldn't just focus on the terrible things. All countries have terrible things in their past. Let's focus on the positive things, victory over fascism. We saved world civilization from the Nazis, which, you know, essentially is true. And the other things we'll just, you know, acknowledge, but not really talk very much about. Two, basically saying all of these negative things were actually good things. The Hitler-Stalin Pact was a strike of genius, a stroke of genius. The repression was, insofar as it happened, was actually necessary. 1941 was not a catastrophe, but a carefully planned fighting retreat, and so on and so on and so on. So it has become now, they embraced basically a return to the Soviet narrative, only now as a Russian narrative, and increasingly, and now, I mean, now just very radically, but before the war broke out already, the war in Ukraine broke out already, an increasing first marginalization and then actual victimization of historians and others who were continuing to promote a more nuanced and very often more dark history of World War II. And there, I mean, basically that debate is now shut down, and in the context of a war which is legitimized as a war against fascism, basically, you know, normal historical operations are likely to be completely suspended. I mean, we're only 2 weeks in, but
yeah,
that's pretty much what's going on.
Yeah. And it's interesting in your book, you sort of also note the extent to which the figure of Stalin moves in and out of that history, sometimes being central, but sometimes kind of being on the margins. And that also tells a little bit about how that memory shifts or has shifted in the past couple of decades. Mark, I'm interested if you can tell us, what is the future of Stalinism? And I mean as a scholarly field.
Well, I think, you know, let's say 5 weeks ago, I would have given you a carefully worded prognosis. At the moment, I really don't know. It depends very much what the outcome of this current war is. If Russia wins, or if Russia, well, not so much Russia, Putin, yeah, whoever, particularly if they manage to take Kiev, we will lose access to one of the few accessible KGB archives and very many other archives. I very much doubt that if the current real dictatorial turn in Russia should continue, that archival research will be possible in the future. I mean, it was possible until recently. I don't know what the situation now is, but you couldn't travel there now, obviously. If not, I mean, if Ukraine remains independent, if there is maybe some change to the regime in Russia, who knows? But at the moment, it looks all pretty bleak. There will be, I mean, we've already seen a new wave of exile from the region, both of people fleeing war in Ukraine and people fleeing the new dictatorship in, or the real dictatorship now in Moscow or in Russia. So there might well be a whole new generation of scholars who want to figure out what the meaning of this history is. So there might be a reinvigoration of that. I don't know what sources could drive that, which we don't already have. So that's all. I'm afraid I'm always reluctant to talk about the future, but I'm even more reluctant now because it seems that the world has changed so dramatically in the last 2 weeks that it's very difficult to actually see towards, you know, the end of the month or so.
Yeah, I think this decade has been very difficult to keep up with so far. I just wanted to thank you for spending this time with us, for sharing your work on Stalinism. And maybe you can tell us what you're working on at the moment.
Well, I mean, the true answer really is I'm working on understanding what the situation of the war is. That's what I spend most of my time with at the moment. But I technically do have two large grants I'm involved in. One which will not be impacted by this war. It's called Aftermaths of War. It's a fairly big team funded by Australian Research Council grant. And we're trying to write a history of the transition from war to peace and the very often, you know, lack of transition or the lingering of the war after the war, from the Napoleonic Wars to World War II. So that's in many ways much of that. While there is some archival research built into that, but really this is kind of desktop research and synthetic kind of thinking. The other one is more problematic. It's called KGB Empire. It's a comparative history of the KGB apparatuses, practices, and archives in Ukraine, in the three Baltic states, and in Germany, so the Stasi, that began in 2020, technically. Of course, we couldn't travel for 2 years because of COVID. Now that we were just getting ready to travel to the field, this war broke out. So clearly, I mean, our research in the in Ukraine has been knocked out for the time being, at least. If this war doesn't further escalate, I will go to the Baltics later this year to do some archival research, but who knows if that's not also frontline by then. So that one is more whether or not, I mean, one can still do stuff about this because there's been a lot of publications on KGB history. There's a whole genre of life writing of Chekisti, for example. It's very interesting, but it's not what we had set out to do. We is, by the way, it's a team of three here at the University of Melbourne. My colleague, Julie Fedor, in the history department, Alison Lewis in the German department, and myself. So we shall see what will come out of this.
Well, best of luck with that work. And I hope you will be back on our program with your next book and next publication, and hopefully in a bit of a better circumstances than the ones that we are seeing today. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eva, for having me.